one, that it's all about motivating yourself. If you just keep yourself motivated, you can change habits. Two, if you can't change your habits, then it's your problem. It's that you lacked motivation or you lacked willpower. Three, just repeat it over and over, 21 days. If you just repeat it 21 days or 66 days, the habit will wire in. So it's a matter of repetition. Next, just do one habit at a time. That's the only way that works. Next, it's hard to change habits. All of those things are not true.
Hi everyone, Drew Perrott here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we're talking with BJ Fogg all about habits. Is there a habit in your life that you've been trying to nail and incorporate successfully into your routine for the long term, but you've not had the ability to do so? If that's the case, this is the podcast for you. BJ Fogg, he's from Stanford. He is the founder of the Design Lab up there. And through that process and his research, he's learned the truth about making habits stick in our life. And by the way, it's not about trying to do it for 21 days or repeating it over and over and over again. Those things could be helpful, but he's going to talk about fact versus fiction when it comes to incorporating habits into your life. His work, which I've been familiar with for a long time, I've taken one of his workshops about like 5-6 years ago, radically transformed my life. His work is powerful. And if you really listen to the simplicity of it and understand how to incorporate it into your life, I think you'll find this is the best, most evidence-based, proven way to build a new habit. Here we go. Fantastic interview. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep in the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset, all with the goal of helping you understand how your brain is not broken. I'm your host, Drew Perrott, and each week, my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest is Dr. BJ Fogg. Dr. Fogg is a behavior scientist at Stanford University. He's the founder of the Behavior Design Lab at Stanford University and teaches industry innovators and students how human behavior really works so they can create products and experiences to help people live healthier and happier lives. He's culminated his life's work so far and teachings into his first book, which became a New York Times bestseller, and it's called Tiny Habits, The Small Changes That Change Everything. Dr. Fogg, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Drew. I'm so happy to be talking with you.
Yeah, and I've just been such a big fan of your work. I was mentioning to you back in 2012, I think it was, maybe 13, I came out to your residence where you used to host workshops, in kind of like not too far away from like Napa Valley, right? Russian River Valley, I think it was, somewhere around there. And I remember you had this beautiful area and there was a little creek or river running in the back. And the things that I remember are we trained goats, live goats. We were training them.
Yeah, those cute little goats. They were awesome.
Cute goats to teach us about behavior design.
Did we train the chickens in the boot camp you came to? Did we do the chicken training too?
I don't know.
No, just goats.
I don't remember the chickens. All I remember is the goats. They were super cute. And I remember you served fantastic wine and food. And it was a very profound experience. So I want to thank you for hosting us.
Well, those boot camps were really fun. We're doing it a different way now. Now, back then, I'd probably coached only 10,000 people in tiny habits. And since then, week after week after week, I coached a few hundred more where I stopped counting at 40,000. But at that point, you know, the patterns of how human behavior works, you know, after 10,000 people, it's pretty clear. But that still seems like early days of tiny habits.
Yeah. And we're going to unpack tiny habits and what it is. But I actually want to just start at the beginning. I just love hero's journey and talking about origin stories. So I'd love to start off a little bit with your life growing up. You know, I know you grew up in the Mormon tradition. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, how did some of those early experiences, what was that like, first of all? And how did some of those early experiences shape your view of the world?
Yeah. Well, you know, Mormons are really, really big into genealogy. And as you trace my ancestry back, every single one of my great-great-grandparents came across the plains with Brigham Young or traveled across the oceans and so on. And so on every line of the family, it's this Mormon heritage. And so I grew up in California in a very devout Mormon family. And I think that really has influenced what I do today. I'm not a practicing Mormon today because I've been partnered with my partner for about 30 years, and he's a man. So it doesn't really go together to be gay and Mormon. But the influence of growing up in that culture, or at least my interpretation, was you are here on this earth to serve other people. And that's the most important thing that you can do. And that's what it's all about. It's about helping other people and service. And fast forward to today, I look at my schedule and what I'm doing minute by minute, hour by hour. I'm not getting paid for most things that I'm doing. And probably 80% of the stuff I put my time into, I don't get anything for it. It's about how do I help people change their behavior to be happier and healthier, especially right now during time of coronavirus. I feel a deep responsibility to step up however I can and to help my team step up. And it does really trace back to, you know, you're a kid, you're doing service projects. You are leading other kids your age. You're speaking in church meetings, whether it's like two sentences or whether it's like, oh my gosh, in front of the whole congregation of 300 people. So you do get trained to serve others, to be a leader, to do public speaking. And all of that is part of who I am today. One of my most favorite jobs, they call it callings in the Mormon church, was to be a teacher, a Sunday school teacher. And I loved that. Even in college, I was the Sunday school teacher and just delighted. And today I love teaching. So sharing my work and teaching people how behavior works and how to change their behavior or how to design systems to help others just is pretty natural for me. And I really do credit my parents and their, in some ways, their devotion to the Mormon religion and that culture and really making it an everyday part of what we did as kids growing up. I'm third of seven kids. So it was like this big Mormon family, and we would do everything that the church leaders were asking us to do.
Mm, that's beautiful. What were some of the expectations you had on yourself growing up, and what were some of the expectations that others had of you?
Well, maybe I'll just call out three. One is there is a strong sense, at least my interpretation as a kid, that you are here, yes, to serve others, but to become better and better until you are perfect. And so there was this sense of optimizing yourself in perfection, which I actually think has been a setback for me. And we might come back to that a little bit later. There was the tradition of things like goal setting. I remember my father sitting me down once a year, like, what are your goals for this year? And, you know, I might've been like 8 or 10. It's like, okay, what are your goals for this year? What is your 5-year goals? And it ended up when I was about 16, and I was like, Dad, the only goal I have is not to have any goals, you know, because I was pretty, I was 16 at that. And then maybe the third thing, the expectation at the time in the Mormon culture is you would go on a Mormon mission, which would be 2 years of volunteer service where you would go preach, you would do service and so on. And my calling or my assignment took me to the south part of Peru, to not to Lima, but down to the south where people would make maybe a dollar a day, and they lived in these shacks and things that at the time were very, very eye-opening for me. It's like, wow, people actually live like this and they can be happy. And so part of that mission, because I was in a very poor part of Peru, was not just preaching Mormonism, but it was also what they called a welfare missionary, where you would help them in other ways. And I loved that. So for example, I was in the Amazon rainforest in a little town called Puerto Maldonado, which was tiny and very hard to get to and very remote and only running water part of the time, when we would paddle across tributaries to the Amazon to teach people who basically lived out in the jungle. And that was really eye-opening for a kid from Central California who grew up in suburbia, quite comfortable, but then going out and seeing how other people lived and experiencing that and trying to help them. I mean, I was a kid, so kind of naively trying to help them when you're 20 and not really. But that was very informative, I think. So those are some of the ways I think that background and that culture influenced, even though I'm not a practicing Mormon, hard work, service, integrity, those kinds of things are just hardwired into me.
Even share, I was reading an article in preparation of this interview, even share this little story about how having a prayer rock was one of the first influences of kind of like the tiny habit model. Can you share that story with us here?
Yeah. So the Mormons have this tradition that their leaders will get up and they call it general conference. And the leaders, which are mostly white men, changing, but you know, white men, they would get up and say, hey, and they would preach and try to help you optimize yourself. And I look back now and a lot of it was coaching on how to control your behavior, how to get yourself to do things like scripture study and prayer, and then share the Book of Mormon with your friends. So the culture really is one about behavior change. And when you look at the missionary training experience that they set, you know, 2 months of intensive training, they transform you from an ordinary teenager to somebody that can go out and you're different. Your name's different. You're wearing different clothes and so on. It's pretty interesting. So then when I started studying behavior change and psychology more systematically as an academic, I was like, oh my gosh, this is why that system worked so very well. So, you know, it's the same culture the Romneys came out of, the Marriotts and so on. So it is a very achievement oriented. And yes, it's a Christian religion, but there's a huge dose of self-improvement. I mean, Stephen Covey is also from that tradition, right? So there's this huge sense. In fact, you go to a church meeting and you'd listen to it, it's like, wow, this is like a self-help meeting, you know, where we're talking and sharing of how to optimize who we are and how we can serve others.
Let's fast forward. You know, you went to Brigham Young University. Where did some of your early interest in behavior design, and even before that, where did some of the interest come when it came to looking at psychology and how the brain worked and researching, and where did some of that influence come from?
Well, you know, I think I have to say, until you're about 19, until you can go on a Mormon mission, you are trained in order to be an effective missionary. And so it was just part of things. And then when you get out and you're like, okay, how can I get people to listen to me? How can I get people to come to church? How can I get people to get baptized? How can I get people to stop drinking, to stop smoking? Oh, to get married because they're not married and so on. So you are hands-on practicing behavior change. And you're just, as a missionary, you're doing it, you know, 24/7 basically, except for when you're sleeping, probably. So that was, you know, I think that just, it was an interesting challenge for me. And then later at university, and I went to Brigham Young, like most good Mormon boys at the time were supposed to do. Although I had a real struggle there because I just felt like I didn't fit. Because I wanted to bring like polygamists to campus to give guest lectures, and the leaders freaked out about that. In fact, that went up to one of the Mormon apostles and came back down. It's like, no, you're not bringing a polygamist in to give a lecture. And I was like, well, learn stuff. So I was a little too free thinking for the culture, but part of that led me to start a newspaper, an independent student newspaper. There was no independent papers in Utah at the time, but PageMaker had just launched. And I was like,
I know PageMaker very well.
And it was, you know, Aldous at the time. And 1.0, and it's like, oh, I can do layout. I can do layout. I can do my own paper. We can get printed. So I coordinated people. And so we did start an independent student newspaper, a weekly, which led me to be fascinated with the power of language to influence people. And so I shifted away from being a pre-med major, again, expectation, my father's an eye surgeon. So it's like, okay, I'll do the pre-med stuff. I'll take the MCAT, check, I did fine on it. I can go to med school. I don't think I am. In the meantime, I'm going to be a humanities person, English major. I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to run this newspaper with my friends. And we made some in retrospect, they weren't radical articles and additions, but at the time it really was, where we were pointing out the polluters in the valley. We were talking some about students who weren't traditionally straight, which was a very taboo topic. And
I can imagine.
It was really interesting to be able to every week put out the paper and have about 25,000 readers pick it up. And then it was like, oh my gosh, through language and writing articles, you can have an impact on how people think and what they do. And that really fascinated me. Boom, fast forward, I decided to go to Stanford to study the overlap between computers and persuasion, and shifted from humanities to become a social scientist and learn how to do experiments. So I became an experimental psychologist and pursued that overlap. I anticipated that computers, and I grew up in a very tech-forward home where my dad built his own computer by soldering chips, and I went in and helped him. This was way before you could buy a computer, so it was very, very geeky, and wrote his own code and stuff like that. So I, growing up in that environment, I anticipated, wow, these computers may be used someday to influence people's attitudes and behavior. So that's what I wanted to study as a doctoral student. That's what I did. Ran the first series of experiments to explore what I called persuasive computing and then later persuasive technology, and did a series of studies basically replicating Cialdini's book, his wonderful book, Influence, and showing that computers could use those same influence principles to influence people's attitudes and behaviors when people fully knew they were interacting with a machine. But those social influence principles, such as praise and flattery, were so powerful, it would still have an impact on people. And that's what I showed in a series of experiments, along with, in my dissertation, shining a spotlight on the dangers of this. Okay, if computers can be designed to autonomously influence people, where might this go? What are the problems? What are the dangers? And so on. So after I got my doctorate, did more work in that domain on the ethics of persuasive technology, and including in 2006, a formal testimony to the FTC about what I foresaw would be coming down the pipeline. Nobody really cared in 2006 about those problems, but a lot of those things actually happened that I anticipated. Yeah.
And you know, we're going to talk about some of that in the current state of the world of social media and persuasion, things like that. You know, in your book, you talk about how you were mostly focused on doing this for businesses and other models and other things, and then it turned inward out of your own personal interest in how behavior design can shape your own behavior. But here's a question for you in the origin story of all this. You were doing these experiments, and a lot of this was theories, and you were running different experiments, I'm guessing primarily with students. When was the first time you saw an outside entity, a business, an organization, use some of the principles that you came up with and actually have an impact with whatever their goal or experiment was?
Well, the influence of my research at Stanford and my book, Persuasive Technology, has been vastly overstated by recent media. You know, they draw a direct line between here's BJ's work and here's what this. People actually didn't believe my experiments. Well, I'm overgeneralizing. A lot of people looked at the experiments and are like, no, you have a flaw in the design somewhere. And other people didn't pay much attention. It was a time about usability, where usability was king. And it's like, no, the next phase is persuasion, people. We have to pay attention to this. This is a big deal. And people in general, industry business people, didn't pay a whole lot of attention until Amazon started succeeding. Now, Amazon didn't read my book or whatever, but then they saw, oh my gosh, here's this company that's getting people to change their behavior from regular bookstores to online. And something like Tamagotchi came out. So it wasn't my research influence on a company like Amazon as much as these things emerged on their own. Facebook emerged on its own without looking at my work. And then people could understand what was going on with Amazon or Facebook or whatever through the lenses I had created. And so it was really more that direction. But if you want to pick an industry example of where I influenced a product, you could look at Weight Watchers And so I went and trained the Weight Watchers team, not in persuasive technology. I had shifted about 2000.
Primarily on kind of community and the influence of like community and like how that impacts it, if I'm correct.
Our work, my lab's work. So in 1998, I started a lab at Stanford. And we did work around web credibility and what's going to happen with mobile. So we did some forward thinking on mobile and mobile persuasion. But we became more interested just in human behavior in general, with nothing to do with technology. And so the lab, we renamed it the Behavior Design Lab because we weren't doing anything in technology about 2010. And about that time, a little bit later, I worked with the Weight Watchers innovators and they revamped their program entirely to align with some of the things that behavior design suggests. And that was super cool because at the time, Drew, I was attending Weight Watchers meetings in the basement of this church in Healdsburg. And people didn't know I was working with, you know, the CEO and the top innovation people at Weight Watchers. But it was cool to sit there in the meetings and learn. And then about a year later, once my concept started rolling out, it was amazing to hear people, and this was like 15 people gathered in a basement where they were using my phrases in my language, having no idea that I had been working with the Weight Watchers team to revamp. So that was a really interesting moment. And I didn't tell them like, hey, that's my phrase or that's the concept that came out of me working with them. But it was, there was this moment where somebody said, I forgot exactly what they said. They said, oh, it's baby steps. Yeah, I did it. I just took a baby step. And I was like, yes, yes. Mm. They're taking this seriously. They're celebrating the fact that they made this small change. And it's filtered all the way down to this little group in the basement of a church in this small town in Northern California. So that was kind of a moment. Yeah.
That's great. And like I said earlier, at a point, you have the story of basically looking in the mirror and saying that you wanted to make some changes for yourself. Mm-hmm. And the question was, can some of these things that have worked elsewhere early on when you were developing the model, can they work for self-improvement? Can I work on it with myself? What were some of those motivations and what were some of the early things that you tried that didn't work in this process?
Yeah, I mean, the motivations were kind of desperation where it was like, okay, I did a startup that didn't work. I let a lot of investors down. I'm organizing this conference at Stanford. 300 people are coming from all over the world. There's just me and one other person doing it. It's just pressure. And I was gaining weight. I wasn't sleeping well. I just felt like if I can't turn the corner now, I mean, this is not true, but I felt like if I don't change what I do now, I'm just going to go down this slippery slope and not recover very well. So I really started... and then there were some personal things going on with family, lost a nephew to an accidental drug overdose and so on. So it was a tough time. Mm. And so I was just willing to just like, okay, I looked at my own model, what I call the fog behavior model. So I'd already developed that in 2007. And I was like, according to my own model, if you make something really, really easy to do, you don't have to have lots of motivation to do it. Right here on the model, it shows that. Well, let me put that to the test. Let me make some habits really, really easy to do. And that means even when I'm not feeling super motivated, I can still do the behavior. And it struck me, it's like that, wow, okay, that's great. And that way I can be really consistent. And then it clicked, it's like, yeah, habit's not about doing a big thing, it's about doing something consistently. Okay, let me try this. And so the habits were, you know, flossing one tooth, doing push-ups after I peed, certain things about how I ate or what I wouldn't eat, how I'd say no to things. I wish I had kept a list. Actually, I didn't. I mean, because you don't know that, you know, 10 years later, you're going to be publishing a book on this. You know, you're just in some ways out of need trying to use what you know about behavior and exploring how do I change my own behavior. Now that I understand that it's not about the size of the behavior, it's about being consistent. And you can be consistent if it's tiny because you're not susceptible to swings in motivation. And then just doing stuff. And, you know, I one of the classes, I'm going to rewind a little bit to the heritage. In the mid-90s, I took a Stanford class with David Kelly. And at the time, David Kelly was running IDEO, which was a big company, but not the huge company it's now. But there's no such thing as design thinking or the Stanford D School. That would come later out of David Kelly and actually one of my classmates. So the thinking of just, you know, you design, you try stuff, you iterate. That was, in some ways, David Kelly really got me going on that. So when I started hacking my own behavior 15 years later, that was natural because I'd done that in other kinds of projects. So it's like, okay, try something, iterate, iterate, iterate until you find the right design. And that's fundamental today to the tiny habits method. You make the best design, you design the habit the best you can. And if it works, you keep going. If you don't, if it doesn't, you iterate. And you iterate, you redesign it. You don't blame yourself. You don't say, I lack willpower, motivation. It's a design challenge. And in some ways, I really credit David Kelly in the mid-90s of training me and tuning me into the power of design.
And to jump in and actually even to zoom out even further, I want to even start off with, like, that was profound back then, but it's still profound today because there's so many misconceptions that we still all have, many that people who are listening to the podcast today actually probably still believe around habits and change. Mm-hmm. Can you run through some of the most common misconceptions? I feel like we can really appreciate the behavior model and everything you teach and tiny habits when we look at the common misconceptions that are out there about how to actually create a habit and change in your life.
Yeah, I'll kind of do a laundry list and you can stop me or we can rewind to the ones you want me to go deeper in. One, that it's all about motivating yourself. If you just keep yourself motivated, you can change habits. Two, if you can't change your habits, then it's your problem. It's that you lacked motivation or you lacked willpower. Three, just repeat it over and over, 21 days. If you just repeat it 21 days or 66 days, the habit will wire in. So it's a matter of repetition. Next, just do one habit at a time. That's the only way that works. Next, it's hard to change habits. All of those things are not true.
I want to take a couple of them and unpack why they're not true, and we'll kind of zoom in and zoom out with your model in the context of it. So what do we know about why the whole idea of, like, takes 21 days or 60 days or 30 days is not true when it comes to changing our habits?
Yeah, it's really baffling, actually, why people actually believe that. If you look at the research carefully on that, especially the most recent piece that gets cited a lot, it's clearly a study that's about correlating, not causation. So what they showed was there's a correlation between number of days and strength of habit. It's not set up to show causality. The stats don't show causality and so on, but people have interpreted it to be a causal effect, which it's not. People can look at their ordinary everyday experience to understand that some habits wire in very quickly. You don't have to, and this is the study where people get the 66 day thing from. If let's say you buy a new car and you have a habit of driving the old car, but you buy a new car, how many days does it take to create the habit of driving the new car? Well, hardly any time at all. Let's say the first time you use the Uber app, and so your habit was getting a taxi, hailing a taxi. How many repetitions does it take of using the Uber app to make that the habit? Well, for many people, it's one and done. It's like, so if you do a new behavior and you have a strong positive emotion the first time you do it or the first few times you do it, that emotion rewires your brain and makes that behavior more automatic. So it's not a function of repetition. Habit formation is a function of the emotion that you feel when you do the new behavior. Wow, I feel awesome in this new car. I feel rich. I feel powerful. I feel, you know, like a cool guy. Oh my gosh, Uber gives me superpowers. You know, I just push some buttons and this, you know, limo comes up and I hop in and I don't have to fiddle with credit cards and whatever. So it really, the tradition of saying it's repetition is not only wrong, but it's harmful. When people believe that it's repetition, then it positions behavior change as something you have to endure, as something that's unpleasant, something that takes a long time, And it doesn't have, and that gets people to procrastinate. I'm not ready to suffer right now. No, it's not a good time. And that's too bad, because you change, and this is a big theme in my book, Tiny Habits. You change best by feeling good, not by feeling bad. And so one of those long-standing, you know, sometimes it comes down to what the journalists write in headlines, or what bloggers write in their headlines and keep repeating. And if you just go back and look at the research that people are citing and say, what is the evidence that repetition creates the habits? There is no evidence that I can find. Yes, there's a correlation, but there's a correlation from hanging out in the gym and being fit. So if you said, hey, hanging out in the gym causes fitness, then people just go hang out at the gym, maybe at the snack bar, and maybe 5 hours a day, they're not going to get more fit. It's what you do at the gym. Same thing with habits. It's the emotional experience you have. So it's really not just wrong, but harmful and misleading to perpetuate the idea that repetition creates habits. So instead, emotions and positive emotion, especially I've pointed to the feeling of success, and people love that. And so they do a behavior and they feel successful, which is uplifting and motivating. And it also wires the behavior in as a habit.
So much of this is re-questioning the folklore and the superstition mm-hmm. that we've believed from society about how habits get changed. And a lot of it is also realizing that, you know, the truths about motivation, you know, and you unpack the truths, you know, you have a few truths about motivation that you want people to understand, because motivation tends to be one of the main vehicles. You talked about a lot of change becomes unpleasant. Mm-hmm. It's not the right time. I don't feel motivated, because we heavily rely on motivation. What is it about motivation that you want people to really understand, like the truths about motivation?
Number one, when you're creating new habits, pick habits that you want. Pick habits that you're already motivated to do. It's very hard to create habits of things you don't want to do, things you don't want. So some people have mischaracterized my work and said, oh, BJ doesn't believe in motivation. Well, I don't believe on tacking it on at the end. Like, I'm going to somehow magically motivate myself to go on the Stairmaster for an hour a day. I say you fast forward it and you make it from the start. What new habit do I want? So that's very important. Next, motivation will go up and down over time. It's this fluctuating thing. The academic research on the dynamics of motivation does not have a long history. And this is really surprising, that there are I can't find any good studies before the year 2000, which is relatively recent in academic terms, that looks at how motivation goes up and down over time. Some research started emerging in 2007 and 8 and so on in the language learning field, of all places. But it's our everyday experience as human beings. We know that motivation fluctuates over time. And the concept of motivation spiking and coming down, that did not have a name. So in one of my boot camps, and Drew, probably not the boot camp you were at, but about that time, we named it. So we called it the motivation wave. So it will go up, but then it comes down. Next, when you look at the overall level of motivation for doing any behavior, let's say wearing a mask into the grocery store because of coronavirus, you have things that are motivating you. So think of those as vectors, like motivational vectors. Oh, I don't want to get sick. I don't want to give others sick. I don't want to look like a bad citizen. Those are all motivating you to wear the mask. But then there are demotivators, things that are pushing down. So think of them as vectors pushing down on those. Oh, the mask is uncomfortable. Oh, I feel like I'm, you know, can't breathe in the mask. Oh, some people, not me, but some people's like, oh, I don't want to look like a sheep. I'm independent. I'm going to express my freedom by not wearing it. So one of the best ways to understand motivation is we have multiple motivations pushing on each other. We have motivating and demotivating. And those are like vectors. They push on each other. And then the overall level of motivation is shifting all the time. An hour ago, I was really hungry. Like, it's, you know, it was well after noon my time. So my motivation to eat was pretty high. But then I ate. My motivation to eat is pretty low right now. So the motivation to eat shifted from being really high to really low. We have daily cycles of motivation. We have cultural cycles of motivation, things like Christmas, Valentine's Day, tax time, and so on. And you can map out these motivation waves. And some are predictable, some are not. And so motivation is really, really important. But I'll just summarize here. What we can't do well is motivate ourselves to do something we don't want to do and keep the motivation level high. You can do it in the military. I can do it maybe in my classes for a limited period because I assign grades. And maybe some demanding parents can increase motivation of their kids to get them to excel in school. But there's no magical way to boost your own motivation and get yourself motivated to do something you really don't want to do.
You know, it reminds me of this quote that a mentor of mine, Serrano Kelly, used to say. He said, you know, finding change on the street is fantastic, but I'm not going to bank on it as a way to pay my mortgage. It comes sometimes, it doesn't come other times, but it's not something that we want to overly rely on. Instead, we want to understand so we can harness it when it comes. And when it's not there, we can use other methods, which we'll get into in a second. So Now that we understand motivation and the fact that there are these motivation waves and that motivation is unreliable, you know, comes and goes, complex. There's a lot of factors that come into it. And so when we rely on ourselves feeling like I'm not motivated, so that's why I don't want to try to achieve this thing, whatever that goal might be. Now I feel like, can you described it big picture, but just let's do it one more time in a little bit more detail. Let's talk about the three aspects to the FOG behavior model and how they interplay together.
So it turns out that understanding human behavior is way easier than people have thought for a long, long time. And it just comes down to this. A behavior, a habit is a type of behavior. So behavior I'm using in the broad category. There's different types. Behavior happens when three things come together at the same time. Motivation to do the behavior. Ability to the behavior, how hard or easy it is to do. And a prompt. The prompt is the cue, the call to action, the reminder. I used to call it trigger, but I call it prompt now. When those three things come together at the same moment, a behavior happens. If you're missing any one of those things, or if motivation is low or ability is low, then the behavior won't happen. And all behaviors in all cultures, all ages, all types of behavior comprise these three things. And you can analyze any behavior in those terms, like what was the motivator, what was made it easy to do, what was the prompt. And you can also use those three things to design behaviors. And in tiny habits, and what we're talking about here in creating habits, you don't later tack on motivation. It's like pick a behavior you want. Boom, motivation, that's done. You're picking new habits. You're picking habits that you want. So the motivation piece is taken care of. Then it's, how do I make it really easy? We can talk about that. You know, that's a big part of the tiny habits method. And then what's going to remind me? What's the prompt? So basically, you're selecting a new habit that you want. You're making it really easy, and you're making sure there's a prompt. So the tiny habits method derives directly from the behavior model.
You know, when we think about earlier in the year, pre also coronavirus, at least in the United States, so many people setting different resolutions and goals that they want to work on. And often those goals and resolutions are quite ambitious and things that they want to bring into their life, a completely new behavior. So I'd love to take a common example, which it also seems like this was something that you were working on early on for yourself too, which is physical fitness and exercising more. So in the traditional model, somebody might set a resolution and say, I'm going to go to the gym X amount of times a week and I'm going to lose this much, you know, weight. So I'm going to go to the gym 3 days a week for an hour and I'm going to make it a commitment and I'm going to tell everybody and I'm going to spend a lot of time doing it. Maybe I'm going to get a trainer, maybe I do group classes, and that's how I'm going to achieve that goal that I have of losing, let's say, 10 pounds that somebody might have. If you took this approach using these prompts and the tiny habit model, how would somebody see a goal and then now reapproach it through this lens?
Well, Drew, I don't want to make this too complicated, but this is my personal opinion. You know much better than I do that going to the gym and working out an hour a day for 3 days a week is not going to lead to substantial weight loss. But I believed that at one time, and many people believe that. It's like, I just got to go to the gym. I ate this big dinner. I'm going to go work it off. So part of picking, and part of the method in Tiny Habits is to find golden behaviors. Golden behaviors are ones you want to do and you can do, and they're effective. And so where I was misled for many years, and where many people have been misled, is that losing weight is a function of working out. And now I believe, my personal opinion, it's like 90% plus, 95%. It's what you eat. It's what you eat. And so that's where you got to pick the behavior that's going to be effective. And too often people are picking behaviors that won't be effective. So even if they are consistent, even if they do create a habit, working out alone is not going to get you there. You got to change how you eat. So the information about the connection, if it's weight, then it's like, what are the behaviors that lead to weight loss? In my own life, it took some testing and figuring it out. And I'd never heard of keto before, never heard of it. I just started really paying attention to my body and how I was responding to foods. And what I learned was there are certain foods that were very satisfying to me and I felt good, and certain foods that didn't. And then I started just, the weight just started melting off of me. And I made this list and I shared it with my dad. It's like, Dad, this is what I eat. This is what I don't eat. It is so easy to lose weight. I'm not even working out. I'm too busy to work out. I'm like, I'm down to like my college weight. It's like, and then one day, I don't know why I'd never heard of low carb eating, but one day I came across, it's like, that's what I'm doing. So my game plan now, it's like a lot of, like my lunch was just like spinach and lettuce and nuts and shrimp, and carbs are just not on my game plan at all. Nuts are, yay, and high quality fats. So part of at least this challenge, and you know this really well, and those on your team, is we got to have a clear, we got to get the right direction. Now, I'm not saying that's the right way for everybody, but for me, low carb is the way that I feel more energy and I sleep better and I get to my ideal weight, and it's easy. It's simple to stay there because I have this eating game plan that I figured out. I wish I would have had some help because it took me about a year and a half to really tune in. And so, you know, part of that is nuts are back on my game plan. I thought nuts were just, you know, caloric suicide. And it turns like, no. So I have like a whole cupboard full of different nuts. I had a whole bunch of macadamia nuts for lunch. And I'm not worried about the fat level because the good fats are things that I welcome. So it's not really quite answering the habit question, Drew, but it is answering a really important question. Yeah, you got to do the behaviors that will have results. Yes.
It's so true. And that's why it's like, again, unplugging from the societal ideas that are there of, oh, you have to do a habit for 66 days. You have to do this for then. This is the way that you have to eat or do that. To bring a little bit of a questioning to ask yourself, really, what is the goal and who are people that actually can help me unpack that goal and proven methodologies and formulas that are the right fit for me? So, yeah. So within that context, to ask you, when you started incorporating these new foods and you started getting some different level of education about what works for you and what didn't, was there ever a time period that you struggled with keeping it in your routine and your behaviors? And if so, or if not, why do you think that is?
Well, yes. I love salty snacks, Drew. I love. Sugar is not that big a temptation, but salty snack, crunchy stuff. And so popcorn was like, and they would not let me put this in the book. Like I had a popcorn addiction and it was serious, but they wouldn't let me put in the book because like, BJ, this is trivial. And it's like, well, it wasn't for me. It was a real problem because it's salty and it's crunchy, and it signified, it signified that you can relax now. So in my family, hardworking, industrious, Mormon family, we almost never relaxed. But the times we did relax, the rare times, my dad or my mom would make popcorn. So popcorn symbolized, I'm off the clock. I can just relax. So I was eating popcorn every night and I wouldn't put butter on it. It's like, okay, no fat. I'm going to do a no-fat popcorn. I'm going to cook in the microwave later. It's like, oh, microwave's a bad idea. You know, all these different ways of popcorn, not understanding that corn, number one, and the carbs, number two, were just terrible for me. But even when I knew I was eating too much popcorn, like people, I mean, we're talking a lot, people. We're talking, think of a big like salad bowl and think of that twice. That's how much popcorn I would eat some nights. And I struggled to stop that because it served an emotional need for me. And, you know, I was under stress and it helped soothe that, I guess. And so I finally, and I learned something about myself for behaviors like that. I am not a, how did they say it? I hate the saying, moderation in all things. I am, that does not work for me. I'm all, and on those kinds of things, it's, you just have to stop. It's not like eat a cup of popcorn or two cups, because I tried that slippery slope. So I knew I'd finally came to grips with my own psychology when it came to behaviors like that, which 2 years ago I applied to alcohol. I didn't have a huge problem with alcohol, but I was like, this isn't helping me and I'm going to stop. And I just completely stopped. It wasn't moderation. It was like, I understand how my psychology works on this. And if I have a little bit, it's going to be slippery slope. So just stop, redesign my environment to make popcorn really hard to do. So don't try to demotivate myself around popcorn, because there's not a good way to do that. It's wired in from my childhood. So make it really hard to eat popcorn. No popcorn in the house. You know, nothing in the house. At one point, I put it all in the attic. So I'd have to climb up through the garage stairs to get the popcorn pan and the popcorn. But I found there were evenings where I would just go up there, pull it down, cook the popcorn, overeat. And then finally, I told my partner, it's like, nope, 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 nope. House policy, no popcorn in the house. We're not. And with that, I was able to, I know people are laughing at me on this, but it's, you know, there are different things that compel or addict. And popcorn was mine. So I really struggled with that. And finally, got rid of it.
Just to interject, it sounds like popcorn was also kind of, when popcorn started, then a lot of the other comfort foods or, you know, foods that maybe weren't serving you at the time, would those start to cascade in? So it was almost like popcorn was the opening, the gateway snack.
Yeah, popcorn. And then I love Fritos and chips. So I had this thing. So I live 2 hours from Stanford. So I drive down and teach, have meetings and run my lab. And I get in the car, come back late at night. There's a place on 19th Avenue in San Francisco where I would stop and fill the car. Or if I didn't need to, I would buy a bag of Fritos and a bag of Doritos. It's like, I deserve this. I've had such a long day and I would eat that. And stopping that behavior, you know, took some design and took but it was related to the popcorn. And what I learned, for me anyway, was for, you know, creating habits and stopping habits are different processes. And so what I learned for me on stopping habits, it's like, nope, it's you draw the line and you never again eat Fritos. You never again stop at that gas station. You never again buy. I was at a special party here in, I'm in Maui now. We live part-time here. And a really dear friend in her 90s. Got this gourmet popcorn. She's, BJ, no, you don't eat popcorn, but here's one. This is really special popcorn. And she put one little kernel in this special bowl where other people got the whole bowl. And it was, when she wasn't looking, I took that piece and put it in my pocket because it's like, not even one kernel. There's no way I'm going back to this popcorn problem. So change leads to change, both good and bad. And so if you change in good ways, it opens you up to other good ways of changing. If I start eating that one kernel of popcorn, then maybe the next thing you know, I might eat some, you know, Fritos there on the table, which then would lead to other things. So it's really, and maybe not everybody has that. Maybe some people can do moderation and all things when it comes to addictions, but at least for me.
Yeah, you're just sharing about your own story. And the interesting thing about it, though, is that you have that in that area of your life. And the whole approach around the tiny habits, which I think we should, you know, include an elevator pitch for and just make sure we summarize so the audience is with us. But the whole approach in tiny habits is that it's not an all or nothing approach. It's not, you have to go in and, you know, all and go into this habit that previously you'd say, I'm going to go to the gym, you know, 3 hours a week and this much amount. It's actually about taking those golden behaviors and starting small, making them tiny so they can be incorporated into our life. So,
yeah, but Drew, let me reemphasize this point. The way that you stop habits and the way that you start them are different processes. As different as the way I plant a tree and the way I pull the tree out of the ground. It will always come back to motivation, ability, prompt, but the way you use it is different. So even though, you might struggle with an addiction or untangling an unwanted behavior, and that might be hard. The process for creating habits using tiny habits is really easy, and it's not all or nothing, and it's playful, and it's fun, and it's a whole, and the book, there's various stories, but it when you get good at creating habits, and it's pretty easy to do that, you can then apply those skills to other challenges in your life that are harder.
That's great. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about creating a new habit, and then we'll come back to stopping a habit and kind of the step-by-step process, even though you shared your approach with the popcorn and how change leads to change. So give us the elevator pitch for tiny habits and the approach.
Elevator pitch. It is the simplest, fastest way to create new habits, supported by my research of over 40,000 people who have done the method, who I coached personally, and measured results week after week. That's the elevator pitch, I guess. The way you do it, I kind of laugh because I'm looking at the book. It's like, there it is. But it can be summarized like this. Take any habit you want and make it really, really easy to do, ridiculously easy to do. So say you want to read more. Well, scale it back to be read a paragraph. Maybe it's read a sentence. Maybe it's just open the book. There was a summer where that was the habit. All I did was open the book. Then you find, where does that tiny version of that habit, where does that fit naturally in your life? And one of the breakthroughs I had in my work was understanding, what does it come after? Oh, so I open the book after I sit down on the patio in the evenings. So what you're doing is you're designing this very tiny behavior into your life. You're fitting it into your routine where it will fit naturally. Just like you'll take a little seedling or a seed, and it's like, where will this seed take root and thrive? So it's a design process. So the tiny habit recipe becomes, after I sit down on the patio in the evenings, I will open my book. Now, some people think that's not very meaningful. And so they might say, well, I will open my book and read one paragraph. It's not one chapter. It has to be so simple, so easy to do that even when you're sick or busy or stressed, you can still do the behavior. So you can be very, very consistent. The third piece, and all of these are hacks, making it tiny, reminding yourself by I call it anchoring it to an existing routine, like sitting down on the patio. That's a hack. Because you're not using alarms or post-it notes or whatever. You are using your existing routine to remind you. Then the third one is called celebration. You wire in the habit into your brain by deliberately causing yourself to feel a positive emotion. And I name the emotion, the feeling of success in the book, I name it shine. So you, and there's different ways to help yourself feel shine. So one thing I did with opening the book was my bookmark had this really cutesy smiley face on it. And when I opened the book, I looked at that smile face and I was like, good for you, BJ, you're reading, right? And that would create shine, which would help wire in the habit. If you're flossing, it could be after I brush, I will floss one tooth, and you could look in the mirror and smile and go, yep, that's how you do it, right? So you're acknowledging and embracing a feeling of success. It's that feeling, that emotion that causes your brain to rewire and make that behavior more automatic, whether it's opening a book, flossing your teeth, doing push-ups, tidying the kitchen, and so on. So there's got the three hacks, the anchor, the behavior that you make really tiny, and then the celebration, how you wire it in.
And I want to start backwards because the celebration, I remember going to your workshop initially, and before that, reading a little bit about your work online. At the time, you didn't have a book. And I can remember really taking away from that and your tweets and the information I can get at the time is that people are just so damn hard on themselves, especially when it comes to change. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And I think you and I and most people listening to this, we all fall into this camp because we're high achievers. And we're expected, to every day do better and better and better. And I grew up in a culture of you need to become perfect. You need to become perfect. And so when you're not perfect or when you don't continue to achieve, it's very easy to not look at your progress, but look at the deficits, look at what you didn't do perfectly. And that's exactly the wrong way to transform your life. And so with Tiny Habits, and in this time of desperation, when I was stumbling across developing the method, what happened, and it was an accident. You know, I valued my teeth, and I thought, okay, BJ, you're going to floss one tooth. You already know how to floss all your teeth. That's not the issue. You need to learn how to floss automatically. So boom, it comes after you brush, you're going to floss one tooth. And then because things were so challenging in my life, I looked in the mirror and I would say victory. Because I thought, if everything else goes wrong today, which it could, because it was a hard time, I got this done. I did this one thing. And then I recognized, so this didn't come out of me doing experiments or reading academic papers. I recognized the going, good for you, BJ. It was literally victory, I would say, victory. That had this power. And so I started doing more of it. And then a year later, when I started teaching it in 2011, I said, hey, everybody, do this thing, this celebration, declare victory. And then as it worked for other people, I started understanding it better. So you're causing this emotion and your brain goes, emotion serves lots of functions. And you and people listening to this are probably way more expert than I am on emotions and neuroscience. But one of the functions of emotion is to rewire our behavior. And so if you do a new behavior and you feel successful in reading or in getting a cab or in flossing, then that behavior, your brain will take notice, and with the dopamine regulation and the myelin sheath adjusting, it will become more automatic. And so that was just, it goes so against what the tradition says about how you create habits. And some people do it naturally, and some people find it such a hard thing to do. And there's a whole bunch of people in between. I was talking to somebody earlier today who called me, and she's a coach and coaching people in weight loss and diabetes. And she, one of her clients was just resisting celebration. She said, what should I do? And I said, well, do this. I've not studied this, so this is a guess, but we're going to study it in my lab. And I'm sharing it here because I'm pretty sure it's effective. But stay tuned. We'll do research and I'll release it on this. Is if you can't go, good for me, or woo, or way to go, or whatever you do to help yourself feel successful, think very vividly about your purpose and how reading a book helps you achieve the purpose. By reading this book, wow, this is helping me in this really important purpose. So for example, my deep, deep purpose is to be able to teach people how behavior works so they can be happier and healthier. So if I couldn't celebrate just by going, way to go, BJ, as I opened the book, I would think actively, this is helping me succeed at being more effective in changing the world for the better. So that's a type of celebration, but it may not seem as contrived to some people. Just helping your brain and yourself recognize that this habit, no matter how tiny, is helping me with this larger, deep purpose that I have. And so that will be an experiment we run at Stanford. Three conditions: one, no celebration; one, traditional celebration; three, thinking about your purpose. And then when we run the study, we'll have some data on, does this thinking about purpose work? How does it work in relationship to celebration? And compare both of those to the condition where people aren't doing either.
Super, super exciting. I can't wait to see what the findings are. And I think just anecdotally, anybody who's listening to this knows that we are often, not only do we not celebrate, unless if you've been practicing the Tiny Habits methodology, not only are we really bad at celebrating, but often there's that voice in our head and we speak to ourselves worse than we would talk to a loved one or a best friend. And our brain defaults to that default neural network. Could be the voice of, you know, a teacher growing up, the voice of a parent who was scolding or negative on you, or sometimes people just hear a general voice of disapproval that's in their head. So that's such a powerful aspect of anchoring this. We know how much positive reinforcement matters when it comes to kids and their learning and their growth. You know, human beings and adults are just big kids who need that same reinforcement when it comes to creating a new habit.
Well, and it was exactly this, Drew, that kept me. So it was about 4 months into sharing. So it'd be June, maybe April of 2011. So, you know, I'm coaching 200 to 300 people a day through email on Tiny Habits. Bam, bam, bam. And a woman writes me back. And Wednesday, in the five-day program, Wednesday of the day, it's like, hey, you probably overlooked celebration. Now's the time to take it seriously. And she wrote me back. And she's in the book. I call her Rhonda in the book. That's not her real name. But she wrote back and said, BJ, I now see I've endured a lifetime of self-trash talk. And you've helped me recognize that, and you've helped me change that script. Now I know how to say good for me rather than all of these other things I used to say. So she was, and since then, I've gotten many, many, many people who have reported that. So basically helping them recognize that either they grew up in a culture or whatever, where they're very self-critical, and understanding that doesn't help you, and instead embrace the successes, no matter how tiny. Give yourself permission to feel good about the smallest of things. I just tidied a pen on my work desk. Good for me. It looks so much better. And by just that, when you experience that, and when you start doing that, it can then change how you perceive the whole world around you, how other people are doing stuff. So being less critical of other people, but acknowledging and seeing the good things they do. And your own behaviors, where when bad things happen, you don't beat yourself up. You're like, things happen. It was a weird day. So what? I didn't go to the gym today. Or so what? I went to the party and, you know, and I ate a piece of cake that wasn't on my game plan. No big deal. I'll get back on the game plan tomorrow. And so you basically, you be nice to yourself. And especially now in this time of crisis, being nice to ourselves and being gentle with others is so important. People are really fragile right now. I've not done scientific work to determine that, but when you just look what's going on, even within your own home or your friends, even though people may be putting on this happy front, there is a lot of vulnerability and fragility. And so being nice to ourselves and compassionate to ourselves and others, and part of that is just do the best you can and acknowledge the positive steps forward, even the tiny ones, maybe especially the tiny ones. And when things don't go as you intend, don't get down on yourself. Move on. One of my students, and he still works with me now.
Story, my all-time favorite tweet, which only came like this month that you put out. You wrote this tweet. You said, for the vast majority of people, the key to unlocking behavior boosting your motivation. Nope. Instead, it's lowering your expectations and just getting started. Be nice to yourself all along the way. That be nice to yourself. Struggle with that. So sorry to interrupt on your story.
Yeah. It's kind of 3 points there. And, you know, that did resonate. It's, you know, lower your expectations, which is like this massive surprise in the culture that you and I are immersed on. It's like, achieve more. And, you know, be nice to yourself all along the way. One of my students, he played college basketball. He told me later, actually, it wasn't even in conjunction with Tiny Habits. I just remember one of my lab meetings, he says, yeah, what we've been coached and trained to do and the way we get to a higher level, something we couldn't do in high school, is when we mess up on the court, you immediately put that behind you and you get your head back in the game. You don't ruminate on that missed shot. And that was active training to help these players level up. And then later I thought, that's exactly what I'm telling people to do in Tiny Habits. When you mess up, you don't ruminate, boom, you just get back in the game and you get back to your game plan and you don't feel bad and you don't think, why did I do that? You just get right back in the game. And so there is that connection between how high-end athletes, at least on teams, are trained to do stuff and the Tiny Habits method.
Yeah, I think about the work of Stephen Pressfield, the author of The War of Art. You know, so much of his, and he wrote a book called Turning Pro. So much of it is that if we start to have an athlete's mindset or a professional's mindset, we can see that there's just not the room for that, and we should expect it. We should expect that we want to beat ourselves up, and we should train for the fact that that doesn't serve us, and we got to let that go if we want to operate at our peak moving forward from here.
You know, the other thing, Drew, that we can learn from athletics, and I'm so sad the Olympics aren't happening. I love Olympics, is when you watch high-end athletes, when they perform and do an amazing putt or an amazing serve, or, you know, a great pass. What do? They're celebrating. Okay. They are. I mean, look at, remember Michael Phelps coming in, bam, raised arms, slap in the water. I have a strong sense, of course, I didn't study this scientifically because I don't study athletes, that the high performing athletes are natural celebrators. Even from kids, when they did a behavior like a great serve or a putt or pass that they wanted to do more reliably in the future, they celebrated it. And that's what led them to become top athletes. So celebration was, so when I have skeptics in celebration, I have this set of YouTube videos that people can watch of these athletes celebrating. It's like, yeah, look, yeah, they're celebrating. They're wiring in that high performance action to be a habit. So they don't have to think about it in the future. It's automatic. That's how they got there.
That's so key. And going back to those three parts of the tiny habit model for behavior change, it's finding that golden behavior, really choosing and being thoughtful about what is the behavior and what is it really for to get me closer to whatever goal it is, not just accepting, you know, something that somebody threw out there, right, or questioning the goals that we have, if they're actually going to help us, finding an anchoring moment, something that's already in our routine, something that we do, behavior that already happens. And then putting that behavior, you know, putting that behavior next to it, right? Putting that behavior, stacking that behavior next to it. We can actually not have to use and rely on motivation for especially the long term. And then the joyful celebrating, the acknowledging that we actually made progress, which is what we do for babies during this time of development, but we forget to do for ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And once people see that, once they do it, they're like, is it really this easy? And it's like, yeah. So I was training so we have a certification program in Tiny Habits, and I teach part of every class. And there was a woman, this would have been like Tuesday. She's like, oh, celebration's so important. She was a skeptic. And then she started doing it. And she says, you know, I used to hate to empty the dishwasher, but once I started celebrating, she says, I love it now. I look forward to emptying the dishwasher. Well, that's a little bit of an extreme example, but this woman who was probably in her 60s was so like, BJ, we've got to get the message out that you change best by feeling good, not by feeling bad. And when you can celebrate, I mean, dishwasher, nobody loves doing that. That's not super golden for anybody, but it's necessary. But by making this simple shift and attaching a celebration to emptying the dishwasher, her whole perspective on emptying the dishwasher changed.
Just that tiny, you know, shift can completely change things up. And I invite the listeners, you know, of the podcast to think about what are the behaviors that are there, and of course get the book so they can be able to look through the lens of something that they want to make a change in their life, something that they want to improve, and see how straightforward it can be. And again, going to the intro of the book, how change can be easy and fun and not this thing that we dread. So because the model is so simple, it's often unpacking the things that get in the way where the complexity kind of shows up. So we already talked about one of them, which is not celebrating. And we talked briefly about another, but that's expectations. And I often find that sometimes people like picking big, audacious goals that are actually very difficult to achieve in a very short period of time for anyone, but they pick it because of their expectations. I should be further along in life. I'm almost 30 years old. I need to achieve this, or, you know, my business should be at this place or that place. Tell us what you know about expectations and where that started really showing up in your work and why you talked about it as being one of the things that derails us from making progress.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I know is I don't know what percent of people, but there's some people out there over the years, they've written me and said, BJ, yeah, I get your tiny habits method works, but I've got to make big changes. So tiny habits isn't the thing for me. Then I'd write them back, say, well, that's how you do the big things. You start tiny, you learn how to do it. So, and some people still aren't convinced. So there's just some people who are not going to be able to get them to, you know, they think they have to go big or go home. And that's the only way to go big is like, or to have a big outcome is to start big and somehow magically motivate themselves. And there's other more direct things I can say, like, how many times have you tried that? And how many times has that worked? But the if somebody's listening to this and you're the kind of person that really can't lower the bar, then do the tiny habits method for 10 habits at once. So boom, challenge yourself not on the size of the habit, but do 10 at once. And that's entirely possible to do that. So that might feel like an appropriate challenge. And the reason I suggest that and prescribe that is by doing a lot of habits at once, you're going to learn a lot about how habits work and how you form habits. Some of those will work and some of them won't. And some of them, once you tweak it, find a better anchor, or you make it tinier or start celebrating it more effectively, will work. So if you're that kind of person that has to do big things, then do a lot of the tiny habit recipe. Apply the method in lots of areas of your life and challenge yourself that way.
It's that classic phrase, you know, we tend to underestimate what we can accomplish in 5 years or 10 years and overestimate what we can accomplish in a year. And I think that expectations is the perfect example of that. We have so many short-term expectations of where things should be. But if we can actually have the courage, and I do find that it takes courage.
It is courage.
It takes courage to actually unplug and tell people that, you know, because there's what will they think, or what will somebody else think, or what will I think? Even sometimes, if you're not worried about a they, I find that for a lot of people, the they is the comparison in their head to other people, or the voice that they've adopted somewhere in their early childhood that says, you should be this, you should be better, you should be perfect, whatever it might be. So if we have the courage to let go of where we should be in the short term, there's something beautiful that can happen in the long term, is what I'm hearing you say.
You know, there's three words in the early part of the book that I wrote, not as throwaways, but I didn't think it would be a big deal. But it turns out it's one of the most tweeted, one of the most underlined, one of the most highlighted in the Kindle version. It's stop judging yourself. And I didn't expect that to be like a big, like emotions create habits. Yeah, that's the headline. Whole chapter, emotions create habits. Big, big deal. I expected that. But stop judging yourself. People have really resonated with that and they get it. And it's like, man, I'm glad that's there, because it's very direct. And I'm sad that they had to hear it from somebody else. Well, but I was there too. So maybe I should be a little more empathetic. I'm just glad it's in the book, and I'm glad people are resonating with the phrase, stop judging yourself. And especially when it comes to behavior change, it's a design process and it's a system. And that's it's not this thing about motivation or somehow you're going to somehow have enough willpower. If you're tapping into willpower, you're doing it, I want to say the wrong way. You're doing it in a less, a not very effective way. And so the fact that you didn't perform the behavior, the new habit as you wanted, or the fact that you feel like you need more motivation, the fact that you feel like you're tapping into willpower, all of those are signals to stop and then go back and redesign and do it the tiny habits way, not the go big or go home way. So those are signals for redesigning. And if you're, you know, if you're judging yourself like, oh, I intended to read and I didn't, well, if it happens the next day you miss, then redesign. If you miss one day, no big. I mean, things happen, especially now with the, our behavior is largely a function of our context. The people around us, the environment we're in, the built environment, even the news environment and so on. And our context recently has changed so dramatically that habits have changed more dramatically at this time than any time in the history of the planet. I'm certain that's true. And some things have changed for the better, like maybe cooking at home and spending time with family and spending time reflecting or playing a musical instrument. And some things have changed for the worse. Don't beat yourself up over the fact that you may not be getting in the kind of exercise you once did. Your context has changed. That means your habits and your behaviors will change take control of your context. So from the very beginning, I said, three ways to change your behavior. From the very, very first time I taught Tiny Habits in 2011, one, have an epiphany. Guess what? You can't magically get yourself to have an epiphany, so forget about that one. But here are the two that you can do. Change your environment, redesign your environment, craft your environment so the good behaviors are easy and the bad behaviors are hard, just like popcorn or whatever. Good behaviors are easy. Well, I've got musical instruments all over my home. Even here in Maui, I've got exercise gear and so on. So it's really easy to do those things. And the third way is to make these incremental changes to our habits. And that's what Tiny Habits is all about. So what we have is redesign your environment and make these incremental lasting changes. And those two things work together.
Powerful. So we promised we'd come back to it. So I want to come back to stopping. Mm. Why is the approach different when it comes to stopping? You talked about your approach when it came to stopping popcorn. But why is the approach different when it comes to stopping a behavior than it is starting one?
Well, some behaviors are very, very easy to stop. I'll bet a lot of people listening to this once had a habit of, even before the coronavirus crisis, they were going to the gym and they suddenly stopped. Was that hard? No. I mean, so I talk about habits being uphill habits, downhill habits, and free fall habits. Uphill habits are things you're doing that take a little bit of care and feeding, such as going to the gym, maybe eating a certain way when you're traveling, maybe doing a problem set for your physics class. So you do it, but it takes a little bit of effort. Downhill habits, once you start, really easy to maintain, and you have to put an effort to stop them. And then free fall habits, where it's like, those are addictions. Those are things where you need professional help, people that, you know, and in part, that's why I created those categories in the book, was to say, look, if you have a free fall habit going on, go find the right person or organization to help you. So the uphill habits are easy to stop, but the downhill and free fall habits, I'll talk mostly about the downhill ones. If anybody listening to this has an addiction that is harming you, find the right person or organization, please, to help you with that. And do some research, talk to people and so on, and find somebody who can help you. Don't just read a book or don't just watch a video on YouTube. Because of the death of my nephew, I take those issues very, very seriously. But then there's other habits like snacking or maybe drinking soda that aren't life-threatening that, yes, you can address. And I talk about those not as breaking bad habits, but I talk about it as untangling. And that shift, I think, is really important because the word break implies that it's sudden, it's dramatic, it's the function of a lot of effort in one moment. And that's not how these snacking or smoking or social media habits work. Where if you think of it as untangling, then it acknowledges it's a process that takes time. It's something that may seem very confusing at the start, but as you progress, it gets easier and easier. And you start with the easiest part of the tangle to unwind. So if it's snacking, maybe there's 12 times during a 24-hour period that you snack in unhealthy ways. Don't try to stop them all at once. And don't pick the hardest one. That's like the center of the tangle. Pick the easiest one and either remove the prompt or make it harder to do. Or, if needed, replace another behavior in for that snack. And then once you've resolved that tangle, go to the next one and go to the next one. And so you probably saw it in the appendix, Drew. I have three pages of flowcharts. All of this is a system. And I love systems. And this is what's so exciting. It's like, yeah, behavior, there's a system, but there's a larger system of how things happen over time and what you can do. And if that doesn't work, then you do this and so on. They wouldn't let me put the flowcharts in the actual text of the book because they didn't want to freak people out. So they are in the appendix, and it's step by step. How do you untangle an unwanted behavior? And it's bam, bam. And if this works, you do this. If it doesn't, you do this. And you take those tangles one at a time and you say, can I remove the prompt? If I can't, oops. Can I make it harder to do? If you can't, can I demotivate myself? If you can't, then you go to the next part and so on. So it's exciting that it's a system, and it's exciting to be able to express it in a written form. And I just, the fact that people are overcoming sugar addiction or media use or gambling problems, or even being harsh with their kids, you know, they want to stop yelling at their kids or criticizing. That's just really, really great to get those success stories back from people. And so it's so, as you saw in the book, I've been asked for years to write, you know, where's your book? Where's your book? And I was too, felt like I was too busy. Felt like I had too many other things going on, that I was innovating in other areas, until one night I had a dream that I was going to die in a plane crash. And I really believed I was going to die. And that, when I woke up and realized I wasn't dying, in the morning I told my partner, I said, my reaction to dying was deep, deep regret. It wasn't about how painful it was going to be. It wasn't about missing you or our little dog, Millie. It was deep regret that I hadn't yet shared my work in a way that was accessible to people all over the world. And that was the moment when I was like, nope, going to stop this project. I'm going to deprioritize this, boom, 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 boom. And then led to me prioritizing, putting it together in a book that includes the system and specific techniques and the true stories of people using it. So now today it's, you know, I think I had that dream, Drew, because, you know, growing up Mormon and just how I'm wired otherwise, I truly believe where much is given, much is expected. And I believe these insights and even the ability to do the research and even the fact that I got into Stanford and was a doctoral student, was able to create a lab, those, all of those were gifts to me. They were given to me, I'll say it, by some higher power. I don't quite know how to describe it in a way that, but I think people get that. And the fact that it was, I was entrusted with those things, gives me a responsibility to share those things. And that's what I wasn't doing. And that's what the dream told me. It's like, you're not doing this. And that's like, yep, you're right. Okay. Bam. And so that's why, you know, having it out in this forum, having you invite me to be on this program, thank you so much. It's helping me do what I feel is not only a good thing to do and an important thing to do, but I absolutely must do. This is my responsibility and duty to share this.
Yeah, it's so powerful. I want to thank you for sharing that story with us and, you know, opening up with our audience. I think everybody can relate, and everybody knows, if you are lucky enough and privileged enough to be in a place where you have your basic needs covered on the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, you start asking, how can I be there for the world? And so much of that is the right behaviors and the right template inside of it to help you do the things you need to do, save money, you know, go towards a goal, write a little bit, you know, a few sentences every day that can help you on the pathway of building your own book, just like you did. And your model is the framework for that. So I want to acknowledge you. I want to thank you, because you've been teaching and you've been giving, as you mentioned in the beginning part of this conversation, so much of your time is for free. One of the things before I even came to your workshop is that you and I hopped on the phone because you could used to keep 15 minutes of your schedule here and there for people to just randomly go book time on your calendar. And that's how the first time I talked to you, this was a while ago, and then I ended up at one of your workshops. So BJ, I want to acknowledge you for being there for people, for having the courage after that dream to prioritize the things that mattered to you in that moment, and for putting out work that is a game changer. And another shout out that I want to give for the book that I really like is that there's this whole section in the back which gives you examples of how to take the Tiny Habits model and for different archetypes. Like, how can dads who work from home use the Tiny Habits model for, you know, in creating some kind of change? How can active older adults use it? How can people use Tiny Habits for better sleep? So when you see all these different examples, it gives you inspiration in your own life of, it can be that simple, and you can start creating new behavior, you know, immediately. So it's very powerful. And I want to thank you for including that template inside the book.
Thank you. Well, Thank you again for inviting me on this, Drew, and to be continued. Our paths will continue to cross. And thank you, everybody who's listening to me ramble on about this. But
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. BJ, it was an honor. You can find the link to the book. Please purchase it. It's in the show notes below. And until next time, BJ.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.